Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I recruited Anton.
This is a real, like, duo now.
Like, one mic. We should have rehearsed. Yeah. Well, we were kind of enjoying the sharing of the mic, appreciate it. So I asked Malik how we should introduce him, and he said he doesn't like the long introduction. So I said, should it be something from the heart? And he said, yeah. I'm like, all right, I'll do my best not to make you cry before you go in front of a huge room full of people. But I'm gonna share that this work, and I think it's been said already, is really passion work. It's liberation work. It's our ancestral responsibility to do this work. And Malik really embodies that. He's sacrificed a great deal of his life and his energy and his, I think, dream deferred in a lot of ways to create space for all of us to be here. Much like my father, who is, I know, one of his mentors and, you know, collaborated as well, Will Allen, and just to sort of be part of that lineage, to see that lineage living in this room and in the work that we all do as we get back into the spring season and thinking about how we're going to feed our people, how we're going to deepen our ability to, you know, be part of a financial future that involves all of us, that's equitable, that's not destructive or exploitive. This is what Malik has been working on. And he's been working on it in Detroit, D-Town.
D-Rock City.
And I'm so excited to have been doing this work for 20 plus years here in Chicago and to be able to be in a position to have this collective, collaborative learning and cooperative economic opportunity to really learn about how to access capital, to learn how to feed ourselves and our communities better, and to build on that as the foundation. So I'm just excited to be building with you, to learn from you, to share, and just welcome you to Chicago.
Yeah, and I'll just add just briefly, because I met Baba Malik two different ways. I'm also from a community here, and I'm from South Shore, and so we out of, you know, pre-woke kids, but one of my cousins, we all in the Ujima family call each other cousins, and my best friend, Keisha Page, that's how I met Bob Malik, because he moved from Chicago to Detroit and was teaching at the Inseroma Institute, where my goddaughter went to school. And then when I started doing this work in food space, one of my mentors, LaDonna Rettman, beautiful sister, another one of the mothers in the movement, said, oh, we did this Good Greens Festival in 08 at the DuSable, and we brought Bob Malik in. So the level of commitment, you know, knowing that there's a network out here, oftentimes you hear what's missing, but you have to also remember on the other end, there's so many parts that are already happening, right? And to give that kind, and these are cousins as well, you know, Detroit and Chicago has this kind of like, we're cousins, you know? In particular in our communities, that's how we see, because the families either stopped in Chicago or they went to Detroit or Cleveland in the Midwest from down south. So we just want to really give him a big welcome. He's one of the fathers in this space who's been not only doing the work, because we have our fathers here, Baba Oren and Baba Fred and others who are Michael Howard, but there's a community, and so it's the mamas and the babas, right? So it's the family. It's not one over the other. So just keep that and hold that and just give him a big welcome here in Chicago on the other shore of Lake Michigan. Malik Yakini, bring him on up.
Peace and blessings. How's everyone doing? So I'm from Detroit. And I don't know if y'all know folks from Detroit, but we like unapologetically loyal to Detroit. So in Detroit, the official greeting is what up, though? I hear y'all be saying that in Chicago too sometime, right? Yeah, but y'all got that from Detroit. Just to keep the record straight. All right. So what up, though? Y'all all right? So first of all, thank you. Thank you to Erica. Thank you to Roger. And I'm going to thank some other folks in just a minute for inviting me. And I always think it's brave when people invite me, because I don't operate by anybody's script. And sometimes I don't know what I'm going to say. In fact, Erica asked me last night, what are you going to say? I got some ideas, but I'm going to respond to the room too. And so sometimes I might go off the rails and say all kind of, you know, like super radical stuff. So I always think it's brave when people invite me to speak. I get invited to speak a lot of places one time. So, you know, it's Roger told me I had 25 minutes, and I'm going to tell you it's much more challenging to give a short talk than it is to give a long talk, because you have to be more focused and more disciplined. So two things. One, I'm going to attempt to be more focused and disciplined and adhere. I'm going to try to be compliant today and adhere to the time restrictions. And two, I wonder if somebody can be a timekeeper. And when we get to 20 minutes, let me know I got 5 minutes, because I get lost sometimes in the ideas. So in addition to thanking Roger and Erica, I want to thank Mirage. I don't know where she is. Thank you for all of your kindness yesterday. Thank you to Rosie for all the accommodations and making sure all of that went well. So having said that, I want to shout out some comrades. Alicia Alvarez, where are you? Stand up, please, because folks may not know who you are. So Alicia just moved back to Chicago recently, I think in November or something like that. I forgot which month. But prior to that, she was the head of the University of Michigan Law School's Community and Economic Development Clinic. And in that capacity, she provided pro bono legal services to our organization for over 10 years. So although she was an attorney, our attorney, I also consider her to be a friend and a comrade, and I love her and appreciate her much. One of the reasons I love and appreciate her also is because in addition to being our attorney, she would actually come and volunteer at the farm. And so I really like people who have both the intellectual side and the manual side and combine both of those things. Because a lot of times we have intellectuals who are in the office spaces, but they don't really understand some of the work that's happening on the ground and vice versa. And so I think it's important that we kind of develop both of those sides. I will give a shout out to Orn. Peace. Thank you. It was good spending some time with you last night. I want to give a shout out to Anton Seals, who just introduced me. Greater Inglewood. Sister Bueza, it's a pleasure seeing you again. I met her in Denver. Who else I got on this list? Emmanuel Pratt, I don't think is here right now, but I want to give a shout out for the tremendous work happening at Sweetwater. My brother and sister Fred and Jafunza at Black Oak Center for Sustainable and Renewable Living. I want to shout them out. My comrade Navina Connor, who I don't think is in the room yet, but is delivering the lunchtime address and is doing tremendous work with the HEAL Alliance and has been doing tremendous work for a number of years. So having said all that, I always begin my talks by thanking the Creator, acknowledging the Creator, and I don't try to impose my spiritual views on anybody else. You know, wherever you're at with that, that's fine, but I make no apologies. I stand on a spiritual platform, and for me, the work I do is guided by a sense of spirituality. So I always start with that, and then secondly, giving thanks and praise to my ancestors. So Erica mentioned something about this work being kind of ancestrally driven, and I'll just say that the reality of it is that we are our ancestors. And so I take tremendous inspiration and I'm informed by the tremendous struggles that both the ancestors in my personal bloodline went through, and I continue to be inspired by them, but also the ancestors of African American people generally, upon whose backs the wealth of the entire Western world was built. Y'all all right? Okay. So I have a chance to travel around a lot and speak to people around the country, but I always make it clear that I'm a member of an organization. I'm not out here. I'm not a lone free radical, right? There's some people, they're not attached to any institution or organization. They're just out here running their mouth. So the reality is I work with a collective of people, the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. We have about 110 members of our organization. We have a staff that varies anywhere from, today it's like, I think last time we were figuring out, we got 0.75 FTEs right now, because we're in a financial crunch. But so we vary from that to up to having sometimes 17 employees, depending on how the cash flow works. And those who are in the nonprofit industrial complex kind of know how that works. And I'm in that, right? I work in a nonprofit. We're funded by grants, but I have some severe criticism of how that whole structure functions and philanthropy. And in many ways, it replicates the same systems that we're struggling against. And I'll just divert a minute and say this about how foundations work. And there might be some foundations out here today. This is sometimes, I think, nonprofit suicide when I talk about this, because then I'm going to the same foundations trying to get money after I just dogged them out. But, you know, what foundations do is usually there's some rich white dude, right? Because in this country, capitalism and race, so-called race, intertwine. And so not all white people are rich and not all rich people are white, but most of the people who have lots of money are rich white dudes. And so some rich white dude creates a foundation because they have excess wealth. And then each year they give away maybe up to 15% or so of that wealth. But the rest of it ends up being invested in the same f***ery, right, that we're struggling against. For real, right? So we're struggling for social justice and trying to create a just society, and a small percentage of this wealth goes towards funding these organizations trying to do that, but then the vast majority of it goes towards perpetuating the same systems that we're struggling against. So, you know, just meditate on that for a minute. And so, again, you know, we go to foundations, we want money, but at the same time, we need to hold foundations accountable, right? I was in a meeting with the foundation a couple of weeks ago, and our program officer started saying something like, well, with our partners, we like to. I said, wait a minute, hold on. Because partners implies some level of equality, and that's usually not what happens with foundations. They come in, they got all the money, and they kind of want to dictate the rules of the game. And then those of us who are trying to get the money, then we end up doing funny dances to get the money, right? So we have to change that paradigm and hold foundations and funders accountable as well, because who knows better what should happen in our communities than us, right? We don't need people to come in and impose their view or impose a plan on our communities. As LaDonna Redmond says, all of the solutions of our communities are already in our community. We have all of the expertise and all of the intelligence that we need within our communities. So foundations should come to us and ask us what we need, not come with some damn white paper that somebody wrote and tell us what we need, right? And this happens a lot of times. But having said that, if you're with the foundation, we are accepting we are accepting grants, and so you know, but the reality is, I mean, yeah, we go after grants, but, you know, we sit down with foundations and we say, look, you know, you should know that with us, white supremacy has no safe quarter. We go, every time we have a microphone, we go bash it and smash it. So if you're not comfortable with funding an organization that does that, then maybe we're not the organization for you. And some foundations, they have an arm's length relationship with us. Some seem to be able to tolerate and maybe in some cases support the work that we're doing. So I'm here representing the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and it's important, again, that people have an organizational base, because this work is not individual work. There's aspects of it that are individual work, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But the work of changing systemic oppression is a collective work. And so you have to be affiliated with a group of like-minded people with similar values in order to make the kind of systemic change that we're kind of trying to make. You can't do it as an isolated individual. And then when we have these groups that are doing the work, the groups have to network together, as I heard Roger talking about, because we're dealing with massive entrenched systems of oppression. And so it takes a mass movement that's over a period of time that's protracted in order to move these systems closer to justice. So I want to encourage you, if you're not already part of an organization doing the work of shifting power, that you find one that you can align yourself with. And as one of my mentors, Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, used to say, if you don't see an organization that you can get behind, then start one yourself. So let me ask this question. I always like to see who's in the room, because the food movement and food conferences are interesting. And even though we have a lot of talk about Black, Indigenous, and Brown folks, at most of the food conferences I go to, when I look out at the faces, people appear to be white. And I say appear because the whole racial thing is, you know, that's kind of hard to, you know, you can't look at a person sometimes and tell what so-called race they are. But anyway, let's try this. Let's see who's in the room. If you are a farmer, stand up and make some noise. Whoop, 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 whoop. All right, shout out to the farmers. You know, several years ago, I was in Mali in West Africa, and I was traveling with a small group, about seven of us. And we looked over, and we saw this elder on the side of the road. This was in a Bobo village. And we said, well, let's pull over and just talk to this elder. And we pulled over, and we had some conversation with him. We greeted him. We showed our respect. But before we left, he said to us, you have to go over on the other side of the road and greet the farmers. Because he said, it's those who work in the sun who make it possible for those who work in the shade. So shout out to the farmers. If you are a person who primarily does policy work, stand up and make some noise. All right, we got Roger up here in the front representing for the policy wonks. Policy is important also, right? And for those who don't think policy is important, ask the people who are being deported by ICE if policy is important, right? If you are an academic, stand up and make some noise. All right, and I sometimes jokingly say, I suppose academics have a role in the movement too. Those who are able to break out of the constraints of the ivory tower, at least, and try to ground their work within the community. Some academics are useless, as far as I'm concerned. If you are a food co-op member, stand up and make some noise. We got Sister Mecca over there representing for the food co-ops. If you are a student, stand up and make some noise. Whoop, 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 whoop. Okay, now we're going to deal with this so-called race thing. If you consider yourself, if you identify as a white person, stand up and don't make no noise, just stand up though. Oh, man, it's a lot of y'all. Okay, thank you. If you identify as a black person, please stand up and make some noise. Whoop, 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 whoop. Thank you, thank you. If you identify as indigenous or a person of color, please stand up and make some noise. Thank you, thank you. So it's always good just to get a visual representation of who's in the room. And, you know, we still have some more work to do. And frankly, because I do most of my work organizing in the Detroit's black community, I'm going to tell you, organizing black folks is hard. For real. It's hard. It's hard work. And it's hard, you know, sometimes to get our people to come out to events like this and engage. And it's hard for various reasons, because we got a lot of all these layers of stuff that we're dealing with, both external and internal stuff. But the reality is, if we want to have a food movement that represents the people who are most negatively impacted, not only represents, but is led by the people who are most negatively impacted by the food system, we have to dig deeper and do harder work, really, to get to those folks. So I want to tell you briefly about the work of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and then I want to hit on some issues that I think are important within the food movement that we should consider. So our organization began in 2006, and actually, interestingly, on my way back from Growing Power, the first time I visited Growing Power, I started sketching out the outline for starting this organization, Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. And so I tell you that we are tremendously inspired by the work of Will Allen, of Erica Allen, and the tremendous example that's been created by Growing Power, and now the children, the various branches that have grown out of Growing Power. A tremendous example, and shout out to Will Allen, who absolutely is one of my mentors. So we began in 2006, and we took what we call a whole systems approach. In fact, some people say to us, they say, oh, y'all all over the place. You know, you're not focused. Because our intention was to try to build kind of an alternative food system that could be controlled on a community level. So we weren't just looking at one aspect of it. We were looking at how we could kind of create this whole circle. And so we started out doing some policy work. And I tell you, I'm not particularly a policy person, even though I was the first chair of the Detroit Food Policy Council. It kind of fell into my lap and I had to hold the work, but that's my work is more on a community level, organizing people and building institutions. But the policy work is really important. So one of the first things that we did is we wrote for the city of Detroit a food security policy that was unanimously passed by the city council in 2008. And that was really a major task in 2008 because there was a great deal of acrimony and contention within the city council. People were calling each other names in the chambers. One city council called the other one Shrek. And, you know, it was crazy. And so even in that environment, we were somehow able to get this policy passed. The policy called for the creation of the Detroit Food Policy Council. And that began in November of 2009. I was elected the first chair of the Detroit Food Policy Council. And we intended to be an advisory body to the mayor and the city council. Now, to tell you the truth, that part of it hasn't really panned out. In fact, I would be surprised if most of the city council members in Detroit even know about the Detroit Food Policy Council. And I'm sure it's not too high on the mayor's radar also. So we have to be honest about, you know, victories and about things that didn't go as well. That's not to say the Detroit Food Policy Council is not significant, because it's done some very significant things. But this relationship with the city government that we intended, I don't think has panned out exactly as we envisioned it. So although we stewarded the Food Policy Council into existence, we don't control it. It's its own entity now with its own board, its own office, its own funding. So in a sense, we helped to birth it as a gift to the people of the city of Detroit. The other thing that we do is we run Detroit's largest farm, which is called D-Town Farm. And for many years, we were partners with Growing Power, the regional outreach training centers that they had across the country. And so many of the systems that we put in place, we owe directly to our relationship with Growing Power, our composting, our use of hoop houses for season extension, so on and so forth. And so at our farm, we grow about 40 different crops each year that we sell primarily at farmers markets in the city, and we sell also at the farm itself, and we sell to some wholesale customers. But probably more important than the number of pounds of produce that we grow each year is the fact that we're developing cohorts of new farmers each year, and also we're shifting the thinking in our community about food security, food justice, and food sovereignty. And so what we see ourselves as doing really is building institutions which become an example of the types of things that we can do to create a more fair and just food system. Unfortunately, most people see with their two physical eyes. Some people see with their third eye. They see things that don't yet exist in the physical form. And so because most people are kind of stuck on the physical level, they need to see physical examples, it's important that we create institutions which become a microcosm of the society that we're trying to bring into being. What's up, Gabby? Detroit in the house. I heard Jason Lindsay was coming too. Where is he? Where you at? Detroit in the house. Y'all stand up, Detroiters. Put your hands up, Gabby. What's happening? You all right? What up? What up, though? That's my peeps. So, in fact, Gabby was in our internship program at D-Town Farm. So that's one of the things we do, training new farmers each year. And so we're not trying to control the food movement. We're trying to help serve as a catalyst so that people come and learn these skills, and then they go out and do what they do, right? So that we're diversified. We're not all, it's not all centralized. Things like that are much harder to destroy than things that have like one single point of potential failure. The other thing that we do is we have a youth program called the Food Warriors Youth Development Program. I'm in many ways a child of the 60s and 70s, and I can tell you as a young activist, I was very naive because I thought in 1969, I thought the revolution was going down in the next 6 months. I thought it was going to happen, right? You know about that? And so we were naive because we didn't understand that this business of making revolution, I know people don't like to use that word anymore, but I'm still on that tip. This business of making revolution is a protracted process. It doesn't happen in 6 months. And so because we now have a more profound understanding of that, we understand that we have to intentionally engage young people in this work, because we can't have all people with gray in their beards and their hairs leading the work. We need to have people in their teens and their 20s and their 30s who are in the forefront of this work, because not only does the way we grow produce have to be sustainable, but the movement itself has to be sustainable. And so we created a youth program so that we can intentionally develop young people who see themselves as being activists and advocates and shapers of the food system in their own community. The other thing that we do is we have a lecture series because we think public education is important, and I won't go into great detail about that, but in our spring lecture series, which starts on March 20th, our first speaker is Reverend Heber Brown. Does anybody know Reverend Heber Brown of the Black Church Food Security Network? If you don't, I want to put him on your radar. He's doing really important work based in Baltimore. His idea is that Black churches, number one, have tremendous memberships, which can support, they eat, they can buy produce from Black farmers. They usually have buildings that have kitchens in them, commercial kitchens, that can be used to create value-added products. They usually are situated on land that can be used for farming. And so he is organizing Black farmers through Black churches throughout the country to participate in the food movement. I think it's one of the cutting edge organizations that we need to pay attention to and we need to really lift up. So Reverend Heber Brown, Black Church Food Security Network. So he's our kickoff speaker in Detroit on March 20th. We also have been working for the last several years on creating the Detroit Food Commons and the Detroit People's Food Co-op. So the Food Commons is a building that we're building from the ground up, and the Detroit People's Food Co-op is a cooperative grocery store that we're developing. We think that it's very important that we develop cooperatives as a way of pushing back against the kind of extractive economies that we see in our communities and also against the control of the food system by multinational corporations who control most of the grocery stores. So often what we hear in response to the narrative about food deserts, and by the way, I don't use that term anymore, man, this is deep. Somebody hear you coughing, a glass of water appears. So Anton mentioned this 2008 panel that I was on at the DeSable Museum, and that was the first time I met LaDonna Redmond. And so I was still, you know, relatively new to the food movement, and I got up and said something about food deserts, and LaDonna spoke after me. And she just, like, bashed me. I'm like, who is this woman? But so I don't use the term anymore, food deserts. But the reality is that we do have a lack of access to good, clean, healthy, affordable food in our communities. And so we think that cooperatives are one of the ways that we can push back against that. We can begin to create closed loop systems where our own dollars stay in our community as opposed to the kind of extractive economies that we see now. For example, in Detroit, Detroit is the blackest city in America. And what I mean by that is that the percentage of the total population of Detroit that is black is higher than any other place in the United States. There are more black people numerically in Brooklyn and Queens than there are in New York and Detroit, but they're a lower percentage of the total population. So although Detroit is at least 80% African-American, there are no African-American-owned grocery stores. Most of the stores are owned by an ethnic group from Iraq called Chaldeans. And just to be clear, I'm not anti-Chaldean, because the same scenario takes place in other cities with other ethnic groups. So it's not so much those ethnic groups, it's more the system of capitalism that pits groups against each other. But nonetheless, what we find in Detroit is the vast majority of the grocery stores, about 70 or 80 that exist in Detroit, are owned by Chaldeans, and the money is extracted from the majority black community, and it goes into the communities where the store owners live. And so this kind of extractive economy is something that we have to end, and cooperatives is one of the ways of doing that. And so those are the basic things our organization does. We uphold the principle that access to good, healthy, clean food is a human right. It has nothing to do with your economic standing in life, but just as a result of being a human being born on the earth, you have the right to have access to high-quality food, just as you have the right to have access to clean water. So I'm getting ready to go into hyper speed, because Roger told me about 3 minutes ago that I have 5 minutes. And I'm on the first page of 4 pages of notes. So the work of creating more just food policy, both locally and nationally, and I want to shout out the HEAL Food Alliance, which is working, as other folks are, to think about what a fair and just national food policy looks like. That work of creating policy is an important part of the movement. But we have to be careful that while these incremental reforms are important, that we realize they're not sufficient. And that we need more radical change in the food movement. In fact, one of the things that our organization tries to do is radicalize the food movement. We want people to push the envelope more and more and more, because a certain amount of reform can be accommodated by the system, and it can look like we're making fundamental progress when we're really not. So what we need to be about the business of doing is shifting power fundamentally, so that communities that have been oppressed and marginalized have the power to exhibit self-determination, have the power to determine in their own communities what happens, and take their own human and material resources and marshal them for their own collective development, as opposed to the kind of extractive, exploitive situations that we often find ourselves in. So also the work of creating a more just food system has to be linked to the efforts to create a more just society. In fact, the reality is that there is no food justice unless there's justice in society, right? Because the injustice in the food system is a representative of a larger, more general injustice that exists in society. And so we have to make sure that we're linking our efforts to create a just food system with the efforts to create justice in society in general. A friend of mine, Raj Patel, in a conversation with me once said, "Local food tastes great, won't end white supremacy." Think about that. So these efforts have to be linked to the efforts to end poverty, for example, because the primary reason for food insecurity in the United States is poverty. And so we have this long-standing system that relegates certain people almost to eternal poverty that has to be changed around. One of the ways, in my estimation, that has to be changed is through reparations. That's a longer discussion, but I just want to throw that out there and say that that has to be part of this overall struggle for justice, because we need a fundamental shift in power and wealth in order to create the kind of equity and justice that we're looking for. The food struggles have to be linked with struggles for criminal justice abuse, for education, for housing, for water justice, and also to protect the environment. So the way we frame our work, though, has to be very important, is very important. And there's these overarching systems of oppression that we always have to be trying to dismantle, even as we're making these incremental steps towards making things better. And those three systems I want to point out, and I'm really interested to see how Rico captures this, is the system of capitalism, which, from the perspective of our organization, is not a good economic system for human beings or for the planet. And there's so many reasons that it's flawed, but it's based upon a couple of ideas that are flawed, I think, which is, one, the idea of private ownership of land, right? This is an idea that came to us primarily from Western Europe with the settler colonists who established the United States. They came from countries, feudal countries, where this idea that very rich people can own the land and fence in the commons was a common thing. So they came here with this idea that individuals can own land. It's a very destructive idea, and it's one that has relegated people to being landless and concentrated land ownership in the hands of a few. That's one of the reasons capitalism is flawed. Another reason it's flawed is because there's a certain logic to capitalism. And Eric and I were talking about financing and funding in Oran last night. And so if you go to a bank, let's say I go to a bank, and this is one of the things I do almost every day. We're building this $15 million project, the Detroit Food Commons. And so let's say we go to the bank and we say, we want to get a $1.5 million loan to help us with this project. The bank wants to know, what do you have that's worth $1.5 million? What collateral do you have? So if you default on the loan, we can get our money, because the banks are not going to lose. Be clear about that. So this becomes a self-replicating system, because the reality is, if you want to borrow $1.5 million, you already got to have $1.5 million or something worth that, or somebody to stand, you know, in your stead and say that they will be kind of almost equivalent to a cosigner if you're trying to buy a car and you have bad credit. And so it becomes a self-replicating system, because those who are always most what they call in the financing world capital ready are those that already have capital. And those that don't have anything, those of us who are most in need of development in our community, are deemed not to be capital ready. Now, we have to challenge this paradigm, because it's similar to, and let me say this, my background is in education. I was a school principal for 22 years. I'm wrapping up, I promise you. I was a school principal for 22 years, And, you know, in education, there was a saying back in the 60s and 70s, why can't Johnny read? Y'all have heard that before, right? And so, you know, often the onus was put on Johnny. There's something wrong with Johnny. There's something wrong with Johnny's family. There's something wrong with Johnny's community. And that's why Johnny can't read. No, there's systemic reasons for this. And similarly, with this financing situation and the funding situation, you know, although small grassroots nonprofits are deemed capital ready, or another word that they use is capacity. They don't have the capacity. They need to build their capacity. This is the same thing as saying Johnny can't read because something's wrong with Johnny. No, there's nothing wrong with the nonprofits, the small grassroots nonprofits. The funding organizations have to understand how to shift so that the system serves those who are on the bottom. That's where the problem lies. So be very careful, because sometimes we can internalize this and say, oh, something's wrong with us. We gotta work. We have to do better. The funders have to do better, right? Okay, there's a lot of things I want to say that I can't because of lack of time, but I'll just say a couple more things in about 1 minute, and I'll sit down. In my estimation, there's kind of two major pots of work within our movement. The first is what we call resistance work, which is really important, especially given this insane person who some of y'all call y'all's president, right? That's a joke. I mean, not the fact that he's insane, but that... And insane and dangerous, right? Really, so resistance work is really important because these backwards policies have real impact on people's lives. And so it's important that we resist injustice at every level. Or even efforts like the good food purchasing policy is important. It's a level of resistance because it's trying to shift kind of the economics. Right, it's resisting the old way of doing things and trying to put in place a new way and a new, better way of doing things. But our whole movement can't be defined by what we're against. And in fact, I think what's more important is that we have a clear vision of what we're for. So again, I'm kind of a child of the 60s and the 70s, and we spent a lot of time saying, down with capitalism, down with imperialism. And then somebody said, well, what are you for? Be like, oh, I hadn't thought about that, right? So it's important that we have a clear vision of the future that we're trying to create, and that, as I said earlier, we create models that are microcosms of the society that we're trying to bring into being. So we have resistance on one hand, which is incredibly important, and we have building on the other hand, which is also important. What eventually will happen as we resist and we dismantle these systems of oppression and people remove their allegiance from these flawed systems, and on the other hand, we build up these alternative systems that show a different relationship between human beings, eventually we'll reach a critical mass where enough people will not be aligned with the old way of doing things and will be open to new and more progressive revolutionary ideas, and we'll be able to make the kind of changes that we want to make come about in society. So finally, I'll say that in addition to representing the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, I also represent the National Black Food and Justice Alliance, and I would encourage you to go to our website, which is www.blackfoodjustice.org. Again, that's www.blackfoodjustice.org. We're organizing people on a national level. We have kind of two buckets of work. The first is what we call self-determining food economies that, as I mentioned, in many black communities, there are extractive economies at work. And so we're putting some things in place to begin to stem that tide. We're beginning the work with food co-ops. And so we are convening black-operated, black-developed food co-ops throughout the country. This is kind of an ongoing work that we're doing to develop our skills and our understandings of how to effectively run those co-ops. The other pot of work in the alliance is what we call Black Land and Power. And be clear that without a fundamental shift in how land is used and who has access to land, that we can't create food justice. And so part of the work of the alliance is to stem the tide of the continuing black loss of black farmland, as well as to try to match up people. Like, we got a lot of urban farmers in places like Chicago and Detroit and Philadelphia who might not have access to land, and you have many black farmers in the South or black people who maybe used to farm who have land, and we're trying to figure out how do we match those things up. But we're also trying to figure out how do we create distribution systems to get watermelons from Mississippi to Chicago. And I know that's happened and probably still happening. Or how do we get collard greens from Georgia to New York City? How do we create these systems so that black communities are exhibiting more self-determination, are less dependent upon corporate food, and can really be striving towards freedom. So I'll end by saying that we need to build a strong movement because we don't fight systemic oppression as individuals. We have to be part of an organization or institution that is fighting those things that are wrong and building those things that are right. And those organizations have to link up in networks so that we build a strong movement. Secondly, we need to link, as somebody mentioned, with international food sovereignty movements, because we can't even understand the problem just looking at it locally or even just looking at it nationally, right? Because these multinational corporations are operating on a global level. And so the struggle is global. We have to link with international food sovereignty movements. And then finally, I would encourage you to be bold and fearless. People only get freedom when they're willing to withstand all consequences. And I'm not on no revolutionary suicide tip. I'm not, you know, I'm past that. But the reality is if you're scared you're going to lose your job and you can't take a principled stance because of that, do something else. Go make popcorn or something, all right? But we need people in this movement who are willing to be bold and fearless, who don't care about consequences, are willing to push the envelope, because that's the only way that we're going to make the kind of fundamental shift. So I want to encourage you to stay encouraged, to keep doing the work that you're doing, to figure out how you push the envelope even more. And I'll end with the words of the great revolutionary thinker Frantz Fanon, who said that each generation must, out of relative obscurity, discover their historical mission, fulfill it, or betray it. Peace.